points.
From 90.7 WFAE Charlotte, 90.3 WFHE Hickory, welcome to Charlotte Talks. I'm Chris Clackham, sitting in for Mike Collins. Corn-based ethanol has been around for over 100 years, relied upon as a source of supplemental fuel for gas-powered engines for at least that long, but never has the country relied upon it like it has in recent years. In fact, the big push to put more ethanol in the gas pumps at service stations nationwide really began in earnest again back in the mid-2000s when Congress and then-President Bush approved legislation to increase ethanol in our gasoline. Since then, more Midwest corn has been planted exclusively for fuel rather than just food, and the number of ethanol refineries has nearly doubled. But now some are wondering if we've moved too fast. Is ethanol turning out to be what it was billed, a good way to wean ourselves off foreign oil and provide a great big boost to the U.S. economy in the form of jobs in the ethanol industry? Let's get a fill-up on the subject from some people who spend most every day, thinking at least some about ethanol. Jeff Cooper is the Vice President of Research and Analysis at the Renewable Fuels Association, the leading group that advocates for ethanol use. Jeff's joining us by phone from Washington, D.C. Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm pleased to be here.
Matt Wall reports on energy issues, certainly including ethanol, for the New York Times and is based in Washington, D.C. That's also from where he is joining us. Matt, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Chris. Thank you.
Chris Kaiser is president and CEO of the Outdoor Power Equipment Institute. They represent the folks who make and use things like lawnmowers, trimmers, leaf blowers, and such. And they've been the loudest at complaining about how ethanol is damaging, especially small engines. Chris joins us, too, from Washington, D.C. Thanks for being with us, Chris.
Good morning, Chris. Good to be here.
Matt Wall, I want to start with you. Got to say, I've enjoyed what you've written over the years about ethanol, like this line. Intended as an additive to gasoline, ethanol in modern times was meant to stretch America's fuel supplies, much as a cook uses chicken stock to increase the volume of a soup. By federal mandate, ethanol makes up about 10% of most fuel that motorists buy at the pump. Unfortunately for ethanol makers, Americans are driving fewer miles and upgrading to more fuel-efficient cars, or to continue the analogy, eating less soup.
Right.
Accordingly, the EPA could rule as early as today to back off some of the mandates for ethanol use that were enacted back in the mid-2000s. Tell us what's at stake here. Why?
Well, a lot of things are at stake. The world has changed since the legislation was written. One problem is the legislation didn't specify percentages. It specified absolute volumes because Congress assumed that the use of gasoline would continue to increase. Because of the Great Recession, because cars are more fuel efficient, because people drive less, we need less fuel. So the fixed volume of ethanol that is required has gotten to be a larger and larger percentage. And the American energy system is really characterized by inertia. It's hard to make big changes. The gasoline pumps at the corner gas station usually can't handle more than 10% ethanol. The cars, it's not clear how much they can handle, but they weren't designed for more than 10% ethanol. So we've got something called a blend wall. We have trouble blending in more than 10%. So at the moment, various parties are urging that we not have increasing amounts of ethanol. On the flip side, farmers are set up to produce the stuff, and it does reduce to some extent oil imports. So we've got two pretty decent incentives, two pretty decent goals clashing with each other in a way that's going to make somebody unhappy.
And are we talking about an impasse here, Matt?
No, we're talking about what we're usually talking about in Washington, which is a protracted fight over regulations followed by lawsuits. But the gasoline, ethanol will continue to be available. It's just that the policy vacuum, the policy disagreement, and the discord just doesn't do anybody any good.
Jeff Cooper from the Renewable Fuels Association, let me get you to weigh in on what the EPA is deciding. Which way would the association like to see it go and why?
Well, we'd obviously like to see EPA stick to its guns with the renewable fuel standard. You know, we see the RFS as being the most successful and important energy policy that this nation has seen in recent memory. It has, as Matt alluded to, it's been very important in reducing petroleum imports and, in particular, gasoline imports. We import virtually no gasoline today. And just, you know, as recently as 2005, we were importing 600,000 barrels a day of gasoline. So we've played a key role in reducing petroleum imports. We've played a key role in reducing greenhouse gas emissions from transportation. So, again, to Matt's point, we've created jobs in rural America. We've added value to agricultural commodities. So we see this as a tremendously important, tremendously successful program. There's no reason to abandon the program, and we want to keep moving forward. It was always the intent of the program to push beyond this so-called 10% ethanol blend wall. You know, the refiners and the small engine guys are acting like it's a big surprise that we're up against this 10% blend wall. Everybody knew in 2007 when this law was passed that was going to be necessary at some point. Now, are we using less gasoline than we did, you know, in 2007? Yes, and lower than what was projected at the time. That's true. But, you know, to use Matt's analogy, we still eat a lot of soup in this country, and there's plenty of room for more growth in renewables.
Well, speak to, if you wouldn't mind, Jeff Cooper, at this particular point, speak to what are we talking about as far as adaptability in automobile engines. Are we talking about raising it from E10 to E15 beginning next year? Or is this a gradual increase?
Well, it would be a somewhat gradual increase. If you look at what the original renewable fuel standard would require next year, it would work out to like an 11% ethanol fuel blend nationwide. But, you know, again, in response to passage of the 2007 energy bill that included this expanded RFS, the automakers went right to work. They dramatically increased their production of flex fuel vehicles that can handle up to 85% ethanol. And today there's about 17 million of those vehicles on the road. EPA has approved the use of E15, 15% ethanol blends, in all cars and light-duty trucks built since 2001, and that's about 77 or 80% of the fleet. So vehicles are not a limiting factor in growing our use of ethanol. The limiting factor so far has been the oil industry's intransigence to investing in the infrastructure to get us there.
Jeff, I'm not sure that's true. This is Matt Wald. Vehicles are a limiting factor in the sense that we got lots and lots of E85 vehicles, but not very many places that sell E85 and not very many drivers who want to buy it.
That's what I said, Matt. Infrastructure is the limiting factor. It isn't the vehicles.
Well,
we got tons of vehicles.
We got tons of vehicles, but there are good reasons. The people who don't want to buy E85 are being quite rational. It's just not a very good value proposition for the driver. You can have all kinds of government policies, but if the policies don't make sense in the marketplace, they don't work very well.
Well, let's look at what's happened this summer as we've hit the blend wall, and the RFS has encouraged and really incented greater use of E85 through this RIN mechanism. We've seen E85 sales in states like Minnesota and Iowa, places here in the Midwest. We've seen the sales of that product virtually double overnight because the price has come down to where it is a good value. There is a good value proposition for drivers, and they pay attention to that. So, you know, I think we're finally getting to the point with the RFS where E85 and flex fuel vehicles are needed. And so we're finally getting to that point where we can test whether consumers really want this fuel and whether it will be priced appropriately. And what
let me tell you how unusual E85 is here in the Washington area. There's a gas station about 3 miles from my house, and they recently opened an E85 pump. There was only one in my area. There's a sign on the highway, E85, this exit. They opened another, and they had the county executive, they had the local congressman, they had people come for a ribbon cutting. That's extraordinary. Somebody offers a new kind of gasoline, and you get a brass band and a ribbon cutting. The reason is E85 is basically invisible in most of the country and probably will continue to be invisible.
we're going to continue.
I'd invite you out to St. Louis or Chicago, or there's several places in the Midwest. And this region of the country, Pad 2, consumes about 25% of the nation's gasoline. E85 is quite a bit more common out here. People know what it is. They're familiar with what price it needs to be in order to be a good value. So you ought to get out of the Beltway, Matt.
Well, continuing with the theme, though, of the E85, what does that mean, Jeff Cooper? What is an E85 flex fuel vehicle?
Yeah, sorry. E85 is a blend of ethanol that's at least 51% ethanol and can be up to 83% ethanol. And so you're talking about a very high level of ethanol, a much lower level of hydrocarbon gasoline. And that fuel blend can only be used in what are called flex fuel vehicles. Again, those are vehicles that have a very slight difference in the fuel sensing capabilities and maybe $75 or $100 worth of extra parts in those vehicles. There are about 17 million of those vehicles on the road today. About 25% of the new vehicles sold in this country this year will be flex fuel vehicles. Ford, General Motors, Chrysler, about half of their output today is flex fuel vehicles. And again, these vehicles are able to consume anything from gasoline with no ethanol all the way up to gasoline with 83% ethanol.
So if an E85 vehicle owner is stuck with, he can't find a pump with E85 fuel, he can use E10.
Absolutely. And that's why it's flexible. It can use really any gasoline ethanol blend from E0 up to E85.
Let me bring Chris Kaiser into the conversation. He's with the Outdoor Power Equipment Institute. Because, Chris, I think you would agree with this. The other vehicle that we use in our lives, outdoor power equipment, has not adapted very well to the ethanol-laced gasoline that we're putting in.
Well, Chris, there's a host of issues here, and I would wholly disagree with Jeff in regards to 2007 and what was envisioned with changes in the renewable fuel standard. No one believed that we would need to get north of E10. Now, remember, by law, essentially every engine product in the country today, every generator, mower, chainsaw, boat, snowmobile, ATV, UTV, automobile, designed, built, and warranted to run on no fuel north of E10. There was a belief in 2007 that gasoline consumption would continue to increase, ethanol would remain an additive, as it had been, and that flex fuel automobiles, now remember, only the Detroit 3 build them, would continue to increase. That simply didn't happen. Now remember, EPA, it is illegal by the federal government to use any fuel above E10, E11, 12, 15, what have you, in any non-road product in any pre-2001 automobile. So I don't think it was envisioned by Congress that this would be the case. Now, remember when E15 was approved by EPA for a subset of automobiles, all automakers, the marine manufacturers, my industry, went into federal court to try to stop that. We are in federal court today, and we're filing additional cases December 2nd, because our legacy product is not made for these fuels. So it was not envisioned. What happened is, as Matt described, gasoline consumption peaked in 2007 and is now falling.
Chris Kaiser, we're going to pick up the debate on the other end of our break. You're listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bradley Arendt Bold Cummings LLP, a full-service law firm serving the construction industry in Charlotte and throughout the nation, partnering with clients of all phases of a project. Details at babc.com. And Lenoir Ryan University graduate programs offering master's degrees in a variety of disciplines from the Hickory, Asheville, and Columbia, South Carolina campuses. Details at lr.edu/graduate. Coming up Monday on Charlotte Talks, for a long time, new home sales and the resale housing market were at a dead stop, brought on by the financial collapse and prolonged by a recession in which buyers were waiting for prices to fall even more. Now the housing market here and around the country is heating up again. But who's getting the better deal, buyers or sellers? can you get a loan? Where are the interest rates headed? A look at current real estate trends and tips for buyers and sellers when Charlotte Talks, Monday at 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. Health and Human Services Secretary Sebelius rejects calls to delay parts of the Affordable Care Act. The Senate votes on a bill to ban workplace discrimination based on sexual orientation. And the U.S. economy grew at a faster than expected pace in the third quarter.
Join the News Roundup on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Chris Clackham, sitting in for Mike Collins. Our guests today on the ethanol controversy include Chris Kaiser, President, CEO of the Outdoor Power Equipment Institute, Jeff Cooper, Vice President of Research and Analysis at the Renewable Fuels Association, and Matt Wald, who is the energy reporter for the New York Times. Chris Kaiser, you were making your point that ethanol and small engines in outdoor power equipment just don't mix too well.
Well, it's any engine, Chris. An engine engineer, we can design an engine to run on anything. You can design an engine to run on E15. E20,
and in fact, Henry Ford designed one of his first Model T to run on ethanol.
Absolutely. So we're often described as anti-ethanol because we simply point out the logistic and use implications of changing the fuel for existing engine product, which is not the case. What we'd like to see is certainly the evolution of the RFS for what it was intended, is to create an advanced biofuel, what they call a drop-in fuel, that would work with the existing infrastructure, the existing gasoline blend stock, and existing engines. My industry was the first to test biobutanol, which you can make out of corn, and it works just fine. But that's the problem, is we're relying on corn alcohol to meet the RFS when we should be moving to what is called a drop-in biofuel. We can design an engine to run on anything. The challenge for my industry is we have 250 million units out there not designed to run on it, and the historic paradigm for 50 years, whatever fuel you put in the car, you could put in the can. Well, that fuel, that is no longer the case, and there's no education to teach people that you could actually destroy your boat, destroy your snowmobile, destroy your generator, destroy your product by using the wrong fuel. And that's what we're trying to do, and I'm delighted to be here to have this conversation because people need to understand that those flex fuel pumps that these guys are describing, if it's dispensed into a flex fuel automobile, that's fine. But what's happening is these fuels are finding their way into products for which they are not designed, and that's not the problem.
That's not true.
Jeff Cooper, go.
Yeah, I guess, first of all, butanol is an alcohol, too, just to clarify. Those advanced biofuels, those drop-in fuels that Chris is talking about, those are being developed, but I'll tell you, they're not going to reach commercial scale if we pull the rug out from underneath the RFS. That just isn't going to happen.
Jeff Cooper, RFS, Renewable Fuel Standard?
Yeah.
Okay.
Precisely.
Okay, good.
But in terms of your point on small engines, boats, you know, every piece of equipment out there today, unless it was built before 1980 or 1978, is approved for the use of 10% ethanol blends. I would, you know, venture to guess that
E10 is not the problem. Everything we're making today is designed for E10.
Right, Chris. So there are maybe 40 stations, 50 stations out of 130,000 today, retail gas stations, that are selling E15. And when you pull up to those pumps at those 50 stations, there is a very clear label on those pumps that says, this product is approved for use only in model year 2001 and newer vehicles. Not small engines, not off-road equipment, not boats, not weed eaters. I don't know how much clearer you can make it.
It is, in fact, a 3-inch by 3-inch pump label, which says attention, which is in English only. And a lot of folks and EPA have found, when they did their mitigation misfueling plan reviews, that fully a third of stations selling any mid-level blend had no labeling, no information whatsoever. That's EPA saying that.
No, that was actually an association that contracts for EPA, and there's a lot of controversy over that particular survey. But the E15 label, I showed it to my 9-year-old daughter a couple days ago, who's a third grader, and asked her, "What if you were riding with me in the car and we pulled up to the gas pump and you saw this? What would it mean to you?" She says, "You don't put it in MY01 model year 2001 or older vehicles." If she could understand that, I'm pretty sure that the millions of Americans that are pulling up to gas stations can figure it out too.
Well, Harris polling has shown that people buy their gasoline largely on price, which is the historic paradigm.
Before we go any further on this, let me to the issue that Jeff just brought up. Linda from Matthews is joining our discussion, and she writes in, "Please address the issue of antique car hobbyist, or in your case, Jeff, talk about automobiles running ethanol-based fuel in automobiles older than 1991.
Sure. I'm a muscle car owner myself, and I will tell you that those older vehicles, especially carbureted vehicles, are not intended for use with higher-level ethanol blends, certainly not E15, and some would even tell you that E10 is not recommended for some of those classic cars. Owners of those vehicles should seek out gasoline without ethanol, which is offered actually at more stations this year than was the case last year. It's incumbent on the consumer to understand what equipment they have, what their engine can handle in terms of ethanol content, and go seek out the right fuel.
Matt Wall, are the doubts and suspicions about ethanol so strong that it could jeopardize the plan here?
I got to go back and question a previous assumption about Americans filling their tanks. When you go to a gas station in my neighborhood, a lot of the people filling outdoor power equipment are not Americans, or at least are not English speakers. I want to jump back to something else, which is we're getting into the weeds here, how to fuel your muscle car. There's a broader question, which is what we're going to do about climate, environment, oil imports, and all of that is in flux. I strongly suspect, speaking of drop-in fuels, I don't know if it'll be biobutanol or something else, but that ethanol from corn is a phenomenon that won't last forever, that eventually we'll find ways to take the leaves I rake off my lawn and break them down, get the sugars out of that cellulosic waste and turn that into drop-in fuel. What we've got at the moment is a mismatch between a 5-year-old policy and the world as it is. Both those things are going to change. The world, the stock of installed equipment is going to change. The biochemistry, the industrial base for making liquid fuels is going to change. What we've got to do is get through a rough patch now. And thrown into that is drought, voluble corn prices, famine, and we can't lock ourselves into a policy. We need to be more flexible moving forward because as the price of corn rises, ethanol becomes less desirable. When it falls, it's more desirable. And we've got these gyrations moving into a system that isn't designed for gyrations.
Matt, what did the drought of 2012 do to ethanol prices or the ethanol industry?
It's like walking on three tightropes at once if you're making ethanol. You got to have cheap corn or your price is above the market level. You got to have expensive oil. If oil drops in price, then the value of what ethanol does is save gasoline. If you save a certain number of gallons but the price of the gallon goes down, people want to save less of that. A drought will do two things. It'll reduce corn productivity. It will drive up food prices. It will put the farm, it'll put the gas tank in competition with the human mouth for the product of the farm. And it probably is not going to last forever.
Jeff Cooper, your reaction to that?
Well, I would say, there are gyrations in any energy market, any fuel market. I mean, gosh, all you have to do is look at the oil markets over the past decade. So, of course, any commodity market, any energy source that we're going to rely on at a large scale is going to be subject to, weather issues, geopolitical issues. It's just the world we live in. I think Matt is right in the sense that corn ethanol is looked at as you know, I guess what you'd call a bridge technology. It is the foundation of what we expect to be a much larger, more diverse renewable fuels industry. But it's the companies that are making corn ethanol today that are the same companies that are investing in those other fuel molecules, other technologies, folks like DuPont and ADM and even BP. But for those smaller players in the market, they need the certainty that the renewable fuel standard brings to be able to make those investments in the long term. Now, on the issue of food prices, gosh, you know, I think all you have to do is look at the Consumer Price Index or USDA's food price outlook. They're looking at lower food inflation this year than we've seen over the last decade. So you know, the year after the drought, when those impacts of the drought are supposed to be working their way through, we're just not seeing that wild food inflation that people were speculating about. And in fact, you know, we hear, well, food prices are up, and it must be because of the RFS or because of ethanol. Well, food prices always go up. That's what inflation does.
Except when they go down.
So the question is, are they rising at an abnormal rate? Are they rising at a rate that is not normal compared to historical trends? And the answer to that is no. You look at food inflation.
That's one of the questions.
Passage of the RFS, and food inflation has actually advanced at a slower rate since 2007 on average than it did in the 25 years beforehand. So this whole food versus fuel issue and all that nonsense, it's just more just another tactic that is being used to try and keep this industry in a box.
Jeff, that's one of the questions, but if anybody on this panel knows what the price of corn will be or the price of oil will be in 2015 or 2020, we probably wouldn't be here. We'd be out on Wall Street making lots of money. There
Sure.
will be future droughts. There will be future volatility. All commodities are voluble. The problem with ethanol is that it straddles two of them. It relies on a price of corn and a price of oil that often move independently. And it raises some ethical questions. You look around the world, the price of corn is going to depend on all kinds of things, including the appetites of people in Asia to eat corn-fed beef and eat corn-fed poultry. But in the long run, this isn't going to work. The productivity of the farm eventually is going to be needed to sustain human life.
Well, I'd say you have a very pessimistic view of what agriculture can do, Matt. And I think, you know, those of us in the industry, and certainly there are a lot of scientists who have looked at this, believe that we have the ability, we will have the capacity to produce not just food and feed and fiber from our world ag sector moving forward, but also a substantial amount of energy. And I certainly would be among those who believe we can do it all.
If you want to join our discussion about ethanol in the United States, go to WFAE.org/Charlotte Talk. Submit your questions that way on the various platforms that are available. Greg writes in, speaking about alternative sources of ethanol. He's wondering, isn't switchgrass a much better source of ethanol and uses much less water than corn? Most importantly, it's not part of the food chain. Why not go to switchgrass as opposed to corn, Jeff Cooper?
Well, there are companies that are looking very closely at using switchgrass. There have been a number of trials using switchgrass over the past several years. Places like Tennessee and Kentucky, in particular, have shown a great interest because they have the right growing conditions for that type of feedstock. It all boils down to economics. If that feedstock can be grown and harvested and converted to liquid fuel in a way that is economically competitive with the current feedstocks, then absolutely there will be a market for it.
Brazil relies heavily on getting its ethanol from sugarcane, correct?
Right, which is, you know, similar to using corn. I mean, sugar is a food commodity anyway. But again, you sure don't hear the same outcry over using sugar for ethanol that we hear about using corn here in the United States. There's a whole variety of feedstocks that our producers are looking at. There's a plant being built in Kansas today that will use the residue left over after you harvest the grain from a corn plant. So you take the grain and sell it, you know, to the feed market or whatever, and that leftover stock, that corn stover, would then be converted into ethanol. So, you know, there's a whole range of feedstocks, and a lot of it's going to be regionally dependent. But that's the next generation of biofuels that we're working on today. And again, as I stated earlier, I'm not sure how successful we can be in commercializing those technologies if we don't have a strong renewable fuel standard policy moving forward.
Chris Kaiser, want you to weigh in, President, CEO of the Outdoor Power Equipment Institute. Pete writes in asking this question: if you need pure gas, how do you find it?
Well, it's becoming increasingly more challenging. You know, the RFS mandates, to Matt's earlier point, X gallons. It's not a percentage of the gasoline consumed or produced. It's just X gallons. Well, and to meet that law, you've essentially had to saturate the country with 10% ethanol. So it's becoming increasingly challenging. Now, what a lot of engine manufacturers, certainly those in the marine community, I mean, there's a reason E15, the Department of Energy, did not approve it for any non-road use. All the testing showed it destroyed or damaged the equipment or boats or products. So you're seeing a lot of folks now bringing E0 gasoline to store shelves. And you're seeing some, certainly in the marine community, trying to identify and localize E0 sales. But it's becoming more challenging as the fuel supply changes. Again, any engine engineer can design an engine to run on anything. The challenge before us today is we simply have a real world, hundreds of millions of engines out there on every kind of product, all designed to run on one kind of fuel. And the gyrations the folks talked about earlier were all price. The fuel didn't change, the pricing changed. And now we're talking about changing the fuels. So E0 is getting harder to find, but there are a lot of industries now focused on making it available as more and more product is damaged.
Matt Wall from the New York Times, is it, as a practical matter, aren't consumers more driven by price than just about anything else when they're looking to fill up their automobile?
Yes, and they're confused about what the price is because a gallon of E85 has a lot less energy in it than a gallon of gasoline. So if you look at the price per mile, while E85 will have a lower sticker price, it's less valuable. And I think the point that Chris is making is you go to fill up a 2-gallon jug to power your backpack leaf blower, and you're likely to buy the cheaper stuff even though it has less energy and your leaf blower is not designed for it. And if the leaf blower catches fire and you're wearing it, you do have a problem. There's a lot of confusion about the difference between a gallon is a volumetric measure. It's an amount of space. It's a vessel that's filled. It's not an engineering measure of how much energy is in it.
Someone was calling in and or writing in and asking that question: does it take more energy to create a gallon of ethanol than it does to use it?
You know, Chris, you touched on that a minute ago when we talked about greenhouse gases. The answer is probably it's energy positive. There's a little more energy in it than you put into it, but it's not very strongly energy positive, and it doesn't have much effect on the climate footprint either.
Okay. More about this on the other side. This is WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Nexen Pruitt, hosting a breakfast briefing for construction industry executives, general liability insurance, insured developments, and coverage for defective construction work, November 13th, online at nexenpruitt.com. And Beacon Dental Center, Dr. Michelle Connor specializes in comprehensive family and cosmetic dentistry and accepts many insurance plans, including military. Details at 704-527-1228. Coming up next at 10 o'clock, it's the Diane Rehm Show and the Friday News Roundup. Guest host Caddy Kay and a panel of journalists will discuss the week's top national stories at 10. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius rejects calls to delay parts of the Affordable Care Act. The Senate votes on a bill to ban workplace discrimination based on sexual orientation. And the U.S. economy grew at a faster-than-expected pace in the third quarter. Those are the topics that will be discussed in the first hour of the Diane Rehm Show at 10 here on 90.7 WFAE.
it doesn't matter who calls. It could be the lottery commission, the hospital, the IRS. It doesn't matter, because you're listening to Snap Judgment from NPR, and they are just going to have to wait. Snap Judgment, storytelling with a beat. Do not miss it. Snap Judgment, Saturdays at 8 p.m. or Fridays at 10 p.m. on WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Chris Clackham, sitting in for Mike Collins. Our discussion today about ethanol, where we stand in this country, relying upon ethanol. Jeff Cooper is Vice President of Research and Analysis with the Renewable Fuels Association. Matt Wall is the energy reporter for the New York Times. And Chris Kaiser is President CEO of the Outdoor Power Equipment Institute. Back to the question, does it take more energy to create ethanol? Matt Wall, your point?
It's probably positive, but not by much. One of the nice parts about switchgrass, for example, is it requires a lot less energy to grow, and it would have a much more positive energy effect and a much more positive climate effect if you could economically turn it into liquid fuel, either ethanol or something else you could pour into your gasoline tank.
Jeff Cooper, your reaction?
Well, this energy balance question has been studied to death over the last couple decades, and the very latest study from USDA says that every 1 BTU that's invested in the production of ethanol results in 2.3 BTUs of energy out. So 1 BTU in and you get 2.3 BTUs back out. And I would emphasize that, you know, most of the energy invested in producing ethanol is coming from natural gas, which is a plentiful domestic resource. There's very little liquid petroleum, very little crude oil, diesel used in the production of ethanol. The other point I'd like to make is that the energy balance of gasoline itself is worse than that for ethanol, and that's really the comparison that we need to be making. You know, energy balance is kind of an arcane metric anyway. I mean, if you use the energy balance metric to determine what sources of energy we should be using, we wouldn't be using any coal whatsoever. Coal would have a terribly negative energy balance, yet, you know, there's great utility in using coal, so we use it to make electricity. So
what we actually use is the dollar balance. What we use is you take something like crude oil, you lose some of the energy when you convert it to gasoline, but gasoline is a lot more valuable than crude oil. We're not in it for energy balance. We're in it for the money.
Well, and I think, you know, to that point with ethanol, people misunderstand that ethanol is not primarily used for its BTU content. It has an extremely high octane value. It's, in fact, one of the highest octane products available on the market. And so that's why refiners have primarily used ethanol in the past, is to raise the octane level of their gasoline that they're producing to the minimum levels that are needed for sale to commerce.
Jeff, I think that's probably true for 3 or 4% ethanol. It really is not true for 10 or 15% ethanol. My old Ford Taurus will not benefit from increasing blends. You could design new engines that would be designed for 110 octane fuel and use an almost pure ethanol mix and come out ahead, but we have inertia. We have the cars we have, and we're not set up for that.
Well, but refiners today, Matt, are almost universally producing what they call sub-octane gasoline, which has a, you know, 83 octane content. You can't sell gasoline at the retail level in most states with an 83 octane. So the way they get that up to 87 is to blend in 10% ethanol, and
yes,
that gives them the octane they need to get up to,
yes,
to minimum marketable,
yes,
levels. And so,
it's but
not
they're not doing it by
4%.
Choice. They're not doing it by choice. They're doing it because they know they're.
They certainly are. They don't have to produce an 83 octane gasoline at the refinery.
They are required to blend in ethanol. If the ethanol has high octane, the efficient thing to do is not to produce ordinary gasoline and splash ethanol into it. It's to produce gasoline that's designed to have ethanol added. If they had their druthers, yes, they would use ethanol, but nowhere near 10%.
Deb from Wadesboro writes in and asks this question. She drives a Prius, looks for pure gasoline because ethanol reduces her gas mileage from 52 to 42 miles per gallon. Is she telling the truth, Jeff Cooper?
Well, I would say if you look strictly at the BTU content of E10 versus 10% ethanol versus 0% ethanol, no, that doesn't make any sense. A gallon of E10 has about 3% less BTU content than a gallon of E0. So if she's seeing that discrepancy in mileage, it's probably because of other factors unrelated to the fuel.
So
now, should she expect a 3% drop in fuel efficiency if she's using E10? Yeah, that's probably not that's reasonable.
So ethanol does affect gas mileage, and on the downside.
Well, again, E10 would have about 3% fewer BTUs than E0. So you could say that there would be less mileage with that. But I would say if you're carrying around golf clubs in the trunk of your car, or your tires are slightly underinflated, you're probably losing more mileage because of that.
The answer is yes. Ethanol is about a third less energy, and that's just the case. Matt spoke to that relative to E85. It just has less energy. It was always envisioned as an octane boost, not a base fuel. And so, yes, she's going to see, as you add ethanol, you're going to see less energy per gallon, and you're going to see a mileage reduction.
Interesting.
Yeah, but not 20%. Not 20% mileage discrepancy with a 10% ethanol blend. I mean, the math, that just doesn't make sense. It defies, energetics.
Interestingly, we're talking about reducing the amount of ethanol in our fuel, the prospects of possibly doing that. But, Matt, you wrote an article earlier this year that talked about making cars that could use fuel that contained 30% ethanol. You wrote, the proposal for a fuel that is 30% ethanol could reduce tailpipe emissions and improve fuel economy and even encourage drivers to use more ethanol. So ethanol is, in fact, cleaner?
Well, the catch is you got to do it in a car that was designed for that. Step back for a moment. We've now got new EPA rules that say the auto companies have to double their fuel economy. That's tricky. Most of them will do it by using a higher octane fuel and burning it at higher compression ratios that today are typical of sports cars may become more common in the family car. If you're going to, and the higher the compression ratio, the more miles you get per gallon. But the higher the compression ratio, the higher octane you need. And if you could do a step change, instead of tweaking around the edges, you just start with a clean sheet. You need a new fueling system, a new fuel, and a new automobile. You could do wonderful things with 30% ethanol. Alas, it's hard for us to try out an entirely new fuel.
The question then becomes, though, how practical is it to ask the auto-making industry to make a more ethanol-friendly engine, though? I mean, you're talking
They want to meet the EPA standard, and they're scratching their heads about how to do it. They can make the car lighter. They can make the car smaller. They can do mechanical tweaks so there's higher efficiency. But if you present them with a system, actually they're engineers, they understand this stuff, you present them with a new kind of fuel, and the automakers and the oil companies have been arguing over fuel since creation because each wants something different. But if you present them with a fuel that will help them meet the CAFE standard, the corporate average fuel economy standard, they like that idea if they think the fuel will actually be out there and the buyer will want to buy it.
See, Matt is exactly right. This is the way to make these kinds of changes. You can design an engine to run on anything and to maximize a particular fuel for a particular aspect. You've got challenging, you now have two policies at odds, the corporate average fuel economy, which says you've got to get X mileage, and you've got a biofuel policy that you have to use X fuel, but that fuel may not result in fuel savings. So he's described an engine exactly right. You're getting a lot of small engines, turbocharged, high-compression product, which need a very specific octane fuel. So like any engine maker, we can design an engine to run on anything, but it has to meet a couple things. It has to be in the marketplace, or it will be available for folks who need it, and it has to match the certification fuel that we all have to use. Here's another problem related to the RFS. Everything is emissions regulated by EPA, even your mower and your chainsaw and your generator. Everything is emissions regulated, and that stuff is designed to a certification fuel, which does not currently track or match up to the RFS targets. And so, again, You can design anything. Now, I would admonish my friends. I'm from southern, small town, southern Indiana. I got a lot of good corn farmer friends, but I also remember gasohol. When you brought in a fuel for which folks were not educated and for which product was not designed, you saw a lot of failure. We should not repeat that again. And so that's why we're having this conversation.
Chris Clackham, let me go back. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Jeff. I just say, you know, this idea of introducing a new fuel to the market and potential failure and all, you know, I want to make sure people understand that E15, 15% ethanol blends, have been in the market for more than a year now. There are 11 or 12 states in the Midwest that are selling E15. They've been doing it for 16 months. There have been probably 40 million miles driven on this fuel. There have been zero known cases of misfueling in small engines or boats. There have been zero known cases of any kind of engine damage or inferior performance. So again, consumers are smart.
Consumers are smart. I would invite you to Google ethanol small engine damage, ethanol boat engine damage, ethanol auto engine damage, and then the article stories and evidence will speak for itself.
Well, if you read it on the internet, it's got to be true, right, Chris?
Let me go back just a second here. Chris Clackham, you started out with the soup analogy. To a certain extent, serving up too much ethanol to the existing market is like holding an ice cream social and inviting somebody who's lactose intolerant. What we really need is a fuel system and a vehicle system, a motor system designed in concert. And that's where, if you figure we're going to have lots and lots of ethanol, which may not come from corn, it may be coming from cellulose, from switchgrass, from something else, you would rethink the system and you'd take advantage of ethanol's very high octane. You would use it for what it's good for and not for what it's not good for.
David writes in. He's an automotive instructor. He has his class listening in right now. He'd like the panel to discuss the issue of water absorption into ethanol-enhanced fuels. Jeff Cooper.
Well, I mean, there is some evidence that ethanol is hydroscopic. It does attract water. But again, I think to Chris's point, in the last 20, 30 years, certainly automotive engines and small engines have been designed to cope with that. And I mean, we don't see that water entrainment as being a problem for modern engines today.
Anyone who goes into an engine, go into a Lowe's, Home Depot, Kmart, anyone who goes down the equipment aisle has noticed an explosion of additives and stabilizers. The engine guy is dead right. It is hydroscopic. It absorbs water. Once it absorbs enough water, it phase separates. Anyone who's in the marine environment has done this for a really long time. You can design for it, but it is a challenge. As you add alcohol to fuel, you enhance its ability to absorb water. It certainly becomes a problem with limited use, seasonal use, emergency use product because it has more time to sit. You simply have to begin to take steps to address it.
Well, that's why you don't leave gasoline of any kind, whether it's E10 or E0, sitting in the tank of your lawnmower over the winter. I mean, if you follow the directions in your owner's manual for maintenance of the equipment, you won't have any trouble.
Absolutely agree. But as E0 has much less affinity for water, as does E10. I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but your engine engineer fell on the phone is just spot on. He's dead right.
Let me ask all three of you, all of us talk about rollbacks, mandates, complicated, very important to the various industries represented on this program. But why should the average consumer care? You want to tackle that, Matt?
Yes. The average consumer wears a lot of different hats. We have a national security problem. We have a climate problem. We have an economic problem. In the long run, we have a resource problem. People have been saying forever, someday we're going to run out of oil, and it's true, someday we will. But we need to move to a more sustainable system. Ethanol is somewhat sustainable, ethanol from corn. Ethanol from cellulosic sources, from corn stover, from switchgrass, is a lot more sustainable. And in fact, the switchgrass could be turned into ethanol or perhaps drop-in gasoline. But the consumer has to keep a lot of things in mind, one of which is, what is my expense for fueling my vehicle? And right now we're fumbling about the best way to harmonize all those ideas.
Jeff Cooper.
Yeah, I think I would agree with Matt on many of those counts. You know, the consumer should care for a whole variety of reasons, you know, not the least of which is how much of our energy are we importing, or how reliant are we on foreign sources of energy, and particularly from places that don't necessarily share our interests. You know, there's an environmental piece that consumers should care about. But I think what consumers care most about is price. You know, we've talked about it. When I pull up to the gas pump, you know, I'm buying on price. And what we've seen with ethanol is that it has reduced the price of gasoline. Ethanol today is about a dollar under the price of gasoline at the wholesale level. And it provides that octane boost. So, you know, we think all those things are things that consumers should be keeping an eye on.
Chris Kaiser.
Safe and reliable use. What we want, we're consumer products companies. We make engine product that people use. Most of it's working product. So you want the safe, reliable use. Because it's an engine device, it has to be, the fuel you use has to be what it's designed for. Jeff's right. They base their purchasing decisions on price, and if a fuel that's illegal to use, frankly, is cheaper, it might find its way into the product, damage or destroy it, and so it's no longer safe and reliable. My members make propane product, compressed natural gas product, diesel product, solar product, battery product, electric product. We're happy to design an engine to run on anything.
Chris Kaiser, President, CEO, Outdoor Power Equipment. Jeff Cooper, Vice President of Research and Analysis, Renewable Fuels Association. Matt Wald, Energy Reporter for the New York Times. Gentlemen, thanks so much for educating us on ethanol.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity.
And thanks for listening to Charlotte Talks on listener-funded public radio, WFAE.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.